I have to go upstairs and record something again, so
quiet.
Quiet and do not
smash anything.
And do not disturb.
Do not disturb.
Do not come into your room.
Hi, you're listening to Pandemic, a new podcast from RTE News and Current Affairs on the COVID-19 crisis. I'm Cullum O'Mungoyne, and most days of the week I'll be talking to RTE's correspondents, reporters and others to bring you news, updates and analysis you can trust. We can guarantee you a high quality of information. The sound quality, on the other hand, might vary somewhat sometimes, as correspondents and I will be recording this, in many cases, on mobile devices from home, so please do bear with us. It's Wednesday, May 27th, and at the time of recording this episode, 352,000 people have died with COVID-19 around the world. The number of confirmed infections globally stands at over 5.6 million, according to the Johns Hopkins University tracker. In Ireland, 17 more people have died from COVID-19, bringing the total number of deaths here to 1,631, and the total number of confirmed cases in the Republic stands at 24,803, after 73 new cases were confirmed today. In today's episode,
we've seen the virus beaten off the streets of our towns and cities into households.
The HSE's Chief Clinical Officer, Dr. Colm Henry, sounds bullish about the level of infections in the community. We'll talk to our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers, about that. And
in our union, we know that the boldest measures truly are the safest for the future. And this is why the Commission is today proposing a new recovery instrument called Next Generation EU, worth 750 billion euro. It will sit on top of our revamped long-term EU budget of 1.1 trillion. Next Generation EU, together with a core MFF, sums up to 1.85 trillion euro in today's proposal.
The European Commission chief proposes major money measures to help the union's recovery. We'll hear in a moment from Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan on that. But to explain the background, I dialed up our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, earlier. All right, Tony, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Colm. I've one child in front of the TV and another in a creche somewhere. So all is well with the world. We can talk without fear of interruption.
Yes, mine have gone to the shop so to fill themselves up with sugar. So my interview with you will help me handle the guilt of that.
Excellent. Yeah, likewise.
Well, seeing as I have sent my children to the shop, they are the metaphorical suffering states of the European Union and I am their great benefactor. Talk us through what kind of money has been talked about today at European level. I've heard an amount of 750 billion. I've heard an amount of in excess of a trillion. We heard the French and the Germans talking about 500 billion last week. So can you just take us back to the basics and break down what all of this money that's been talked about is and how it divides up?
Sure. So it's probably good to start back a few weeks ago, and we discussed this on the podcast on a few occasions, that the EU has already kind of mobilized 540 billion, and that was agreed at some considerable difficulty, as you recall, by European finance ministers over a 2 or 3 week period, and they got EU leaders to sign off on it eventually. And that was basically money from the European Stability Mechanism, which is the EU's bailout fund, money from the European Investment Bank for the corporate sector, kind of soft loans, and then about 100 billion that would be mobilized by the Commission, again, borrowing in the market to help companies keep on workers on their books so the European economy could bounce back. So that's 540 billion that was already over the line. Then the French and the Germans last week proposed a recovery fund of 500 billion. What the Commission has done today is it's announced its recovery fund, or its proposed recovery fund, and that's 750 billion. Okay.
So is that on top of the 540 billion that you've already mentioned?
Yes.
It is.
Yes.
Okay.
So that's on top of that. So the 540 is already kind of over the line and agreed and everything. So this 750 billion from the Commission is a proposal. What they're doing is they're kind of weaponizing the EU 7-year budget. Now, the 7-year budget runs out at the end of this year. So there were negotiations anyway going on between member states on the next 7-year budget. And those negotiations were, as expected, fairly fractious. You had the Frugal Four, Denmark, the Netherlands, Sweden and Austria, saying that the budget had to be kept to 1% of Europe's economic output, other member states saying, no, it should be much higher, 1.1, 1.14, and so on. That sort of scrap was ongoing before the pandemic hit. Now, what the Commission is doing here is they're saying what we can repurpose and front-load the seven-year budget to allow us, the European Commission, to go on to the financial markets and borrow 750 billion euro at very cheap rates and long maturity dates. And then we will channel that money by way of loans and grants to member states and sectors and regions which need it most. If you add in the European budget itself, which the Commission today said should be around 1.1 trillion euro over 7 years, they've bundled the whole thing together and said the overall EU rescue bazooka is 3.1 trillion euro, which is obviously a huge amount of money, but it's not agreed by the member states, and that's going to be the next stage.
Sorry, the agreement amongst the member states then might be the more difficult bit to achieve, because as you say, the proposal is that this will break down as a mixture of loans and grants. How much of it will be loans? How much of it will be grants? What's the conditionality of the loans? And how does the European Commission propose to pay back the money? What are its revenue raising measures? These are the tricky bits, are they?
Yeah, they are. So under today's proposals, 500 billion would be in grants and 250 billion would be in loans. Now, the Dutch have been out very quickly. They put out a statement via a Dutch diplomat saying that the final figure would be some distance from the Commission's proposal today. But that is going to be one of the keynote debates in the next few weeks. How much should be loans? How much should be grants? The grants would be straightforward. It's just free money, effectively. And the Commission says the beauty of their proposal is that they're using the structure of the EU budget, the seven-year budget, to channel money to places where it's needed. So member states get cohesion money. That's basically grants, free money. They can use the same structures and mechanisms to get this new overall 750 billion euro channeled through those existing structures. So the way they're going to raise the money is that at the moment, 2% of the EU budget comes from what is called own resources. Okay, so the vast
tariffs and stuff.
Yeah, tariffs, VAT.
Fines.
Some of the big fines that companies like Google and Microsoft have paid. Those are basically the own resources. The rest of the money, as you know, comes from member states' national coffers. Now, the Commission today is saying we could raise more by way of own resources. They've talked about using the emissions trading scheme, which allows member states to trade carbon emissions as part of their climate change targets. They could tax exports coming into the EU that have been generated using dirty industries. There's a plan for a plastics tax so that for every ton of single-use plastic that gets dumped, a member state will pay a tax into the EU budget. And there's talk of using a new digital tax. There's talk of even taxing some big corporations in a one-off way.
Right. So, as you say, there's talk, but I mean, that sounds like we're coming to quite a fractious summit at some point, or many of them, to hammer this out. Because a digital tax, the Dutch and the Irish aren't going to like that. Some of the single-use plastic taxes, there'll be others who are against that. So there's people will coalesce in opposition around the various revenue-raising measures. They might even agree in principle the whole thing is a great idea, but they may not just want to be paying for it.
Yeah. The thing is, though, that those arguments, you know, would have been in a different climate if they had been expressed back in January or December of last year. Everything is different now. The world is a different place. And if you are putting forward those arguments that you don't like these own resources tax raising approaches by the European Commission, then you could be starving, you know, Italian hospitals of badly needed funds. You could be starving Spain of money that's needed to pay off the huge cost of their tackling the pandemic. And so there's a different moral weight to these kind of arguments. And I think that's something the Commission is going to be banking on.
Would it be fair to say that Italy is the key to this? Because back in the last financial crisis, the so-called pigs were peripheral economies and the central European economies weren't necessarily integrated with them. The nightmare scenario for Germany, for Austria, is if the Italian economy gets into difficulty their economies are far more integrated with that, and it presents them with a domestic economic problem in a way that the last crisis wouldn't have.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall the way the Commission and increasingly member states, and I think the Franco-German proposal is indicative of a quite a sober shift in the political center of gravity here. You know, there are certain member states who had the fiscal space to take the hit sort of head on. There was a massive economic hit all round, but certain countries like Ireland, according to people I've spoken to, who had the fiscal space to deal with it. The countries that have really suffered the greatest numbers of deaths are, by whatever calculation, the countries that also have had the least fiscal headway to deal with this. So that's where the thinking is, that you have to level up and allow those countries to recover. Another important guiding principle here is that they're not talking about throwing money at the kind of existing models of the European economy. They want this money to be targeted towards the digital agenda, the European Green Deal, so that they're not just patching up holes in the European system, they're actually making it fit for purpose for the 21st century. That's the kind of buzz language that they're using anyway. Whether that works out or not is another question. But another guiding principle is, and this is something that you'll hear from the Department of Finance in Dublin, the single market needs to be operating at all levels. Otherwise, we as Irish exporters don't have people to export to. If Italy and Spain and France are really stricken and have a recession that is asymmetric to other parts of Europe.
Tony, we've just talked about Europe's financial Big Philip. You're on your way to talk to another Big Philip.
That's right. Yeah. Big Phil, as he's known across the board now in European circles, Phil Hogan, Ireland's commissioner. I'm going to have to speak to him now shortly on today's announcement by the Commission and also on Brexit.
A
bit of Brexity inclinations to get off his chest. Quite a bit has been happening on the Brexit front with fisheries and another round of negotiations next week. We should really get our Brexit Republic back on the airwaves, if that's not a cheeky utilization of a rival podcast.
It is. No, that's fine. I'm all on board with you on that one. But before I let you go, what's the protocols for getting into the Berlaymont, the European Commission headquarters building? What kind of precautions do you have to take? Are you going to be masked up? Will you be talking to Phil Hogan at the end of a 6-foot pole? What kind of things are you dealing with?
Well, the protocols that I'm following are more kind of RTE's guidelines. RTE has issued fairly robust and detailed guidelines about how to interview people. And basically, Phil Hogan's going to come out of the Berlaymont building and we'll do the interview there. So I'm going to travel separately from the cameraman on my bike, and the cameraman will have a boom mic, so we can hold the mic 2 meters from the man himself, and the cameraman will have gloves. He'll be able to wipe down the camera before and after, and the RT mic cover has to be sterilized as well, because of course one way of transmitting the virus is through speech and articulation, just in case there are any particles flying around that we don't want to be getting on our mics. Phil Hogan has had to just notify us that he hasn't had any symptoms in the past 14 days. All of that is following the RT guidelines.
Which sounds like instructions for cleaning up a crime scene, but there you go.
Exactly.
Hopefully that won't reflect in any way on the interview you're about to do. Okay.
unless he leaks something absolutely stratospheric.
Here's hoping.
That would be a crime. Good to talk to you.
Same to you. All the best.
Commissioner, this is a sizable amount of money. Can you just let us know how that's going to be dispersed, if it does get political approval? How's it going to work?
Yeah, well, as you know, we've gone through the biggest economic and social crisis since World War I, effectively. And a lot of money has been freed up with state aid rules being relaxed and other funds being relaxed. But this was the turn of the budget of the European Union for the next 7 years. And there's been almost a 70% increase in the budget for the next 7 years, €750 billion extra on top of the 1.1 trillion that we normally would use. So in an Irish context, this would mean that an additional €2 billion is available for to do certain things in the Irish budgetary context for economic recovery, for just transition fund in respect of the environment and climate obligations, social funds in respect of the liquidity for people and for businesses, small businesses in particular. So all in all, the agricultural community as well are getting additional money in terms of rural development programmes. So I believe that this is a very sensible package for a difficult time. So we have had a big problem, so we have to have a big response. And I think the €1.85 trillion should have an impact over the next 7 years.
But essentially, the Commission will use its own resources and raise the ceiling there to borrow money on the markets at favourable rates. And then that in turn will be passed on to the member states that need it.
Yeah, well, legally we have to ask the permission of the member states to go guarantee through own resources, as we call them, and that's plastic levies or digital taxes or whatever they wish to take off the menu of own resources. And this allows the Commission, who have a AAA banking rating, to be able to borrow this money on behalf of all of the member states. But it's voluntary. It's up to the member states whether they wish to use this facility or not. But there are certain member states that have difficulty in getting cheap money on the markets because of the situation they're in. And this is an opportunity for them in order to be able to get money at a reasonably low cost through this small, one-third of the facility will be through loans. So they'll be able to avail of this money and be able to repay it over a period of 30 years in relation to the own resources that I mentioned.
Do you think that member states are going to approve this readily, because there's still very strong resistance from the so-called Frugal Four to having any kind of grant provision? That they would prefer to have loans that member states can pay back, and that there would be a certain amount of conditionality to those loans.
Well, look, at the end of the day, it's going to be up to the member states and the European Parliament to decide what they want. You know, they can't have it every way, because the European Commission now has responded to their concerns by having, you know, grants and loans as a mixture. And the European Parliament are looking for a lot more money. The Frugal Four are looking for some less money. So hopefully we'll reach a balanced outcome. But I think it's very important for the stability and predictability of the European Union in responding to this very big crisis that we show unity, solidarity, and every member state hopefully will be able to buy into this package.
Ireland, as a net contributor, is going to have to look at this carefully, because, you know, it may well be that Ireland puts more in to this package than it gets out of it. I mean, what would your advice be to the Irish government in terms of how it can utilise this rescue recovery fund, but at the same time make sure that everybody's getting value for money?
Well, 60% of the funds have to go for the European Union priorities of the European Green Deal and the digital transition. So, you know, this is very important in terms of using the crisis in order to modernise our economic models and, you know, justify the policy implementation through these funds, through the budget of the next 7 years. So Ireland and 22 other member states have said that they're prepared to put more money into the budget. It's only four countries have said that they won't at this stage. But hopefully this package, which is very balanced, will give them an opportunity to see that there's something in it for everybody, and that we can come together in unity and solidarity to get ourselves out of this particular very difficult situation for the benefit of the people that we all represent.
Now, there's one of the own resources ideas has been a digital tax. There's also talk of a CCTTB, a common consolidated corporate tax base. I mean, these are issues that the Irish government, present and past, have had real problems with. I mean, do you think this is going to pose difficulties for Ireland politically to embrace some of these new ideas?
No, first of all, to borrow money through this mechanism in the European Commission is voluntary for a member state. Second of all, it'll be a menu of options they will get in relation to own resources. They'll also have alternatives like the plastic tax or the ETS system, the emissions trading system. So there are various options in a flexible way that will be given to member states if they wish to participate in any of these instruments and any of these funds. So, but the most important is that we invest in the future. This fund today that's announced by the European Commission is about the future, and about the economic recovery, and about our young people in the future. It's about next generation EU. So hopefully we'll be able to, that people will be able to be reasonable and see it this way, and be able to build the economic and social cohesion that we need for the future, and to repair a lot of the damage that's been done in our societies and in our economies due to COVID-19.
Now, at the start of this episode, we heard this.
We've now seen a 70% reduction in the number of people in intensive care units, and 70% reduction in the number of people with COVID-19 in our hospitals. We've seen the virus beaten off the streets of our towns and cities into households, so much so that the number of contacts per identified case has gone from a peak of about 20 now to less than 3, in some cases 2. And those gains have been hard fought for, and they came in because of those measures introduced March the 27th, and we as a single people adhering to those measures in order that we could break that chain of transmission and bend that curve and effectively extinguish the virus in our streets.
That was the Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE, Dr. Colm Henry. And on that and more, we're going to check in with our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers, who I spoke to earlier. All right, Fergal, how are you?
I'm good. We're into the middle of the week now, and the National Public Health Emergency Team will meet tomorrow. But we also then, yesterday, we had the COVID-19 committee hearing from nursing homes, and also some commentary from Dr. Colm Henry, the clinical leader of the HSC, on where we are with the virus.
Yeah, he was out this morning on Morning Ireland, and quite the statement to make.
He was talking about how, you know, we've beaten the virus off the streets, really, into homes. And even last night he was saying, you know, if COVID-19, if it's not extinguished, it's virtually extinguished. So, I mean, that's a significant position to be in now. And we've gone from what he said was a peak of 25% of cases testing positive to now 2% cases testing positive. And the turnaround time for tests from a swab to even contact tracing is about 3 days. So it's a good position to be in at this point.
The pressure is going to grow, presumably, if people think that the virus is on the run, that people can have more freedom. It's going to be a difficult balancing act for the health authorities and also, obviously, the political decision makers.
Well, it is. I mean, when you look, okay, we were talking there about the number, you know, of cases that you see in terms of testing and in the community. And then if you turn your sights to the hospital system, the numbers are reducing significantly. There's 390 patients in hospital with COVID-19 or suspected COVID-19. And that's down from 500 a day ago. And the numbers in ICU are going down too. There are notable reductions in the number of cases. And it does mean that hospitals are well able to cope with the cases they're now seeing in relation to coronavirus and do have additional capacity to start dealing with non-COVID care, which really does need to start to happen again soon, so that waiting lists can begin to reduce. They're very, very high. The last waiting list figures were 770,000 people waiting either to be seen at a clinic or to be get into hospital for some sort of treatment. Those patients can't wait.
And within the hospital system, Fergal, intensive care unit figures are ones that we've been keeping an eye on as indicative of the presence of the disease in the wider community. Where are we at with that at the moment? What can we tell, I suppose, from the serious cases that are in hospital at the moment?
Well, ICU was always a big indicator to watch out for in terms of this virus. You know, the number of people hospitalized and the numbers then going into ICU were very significant and serious. So as we speak, there's 48 patients in intensive care units plus 14 with suspected COVID-19. So those numbers are down significantly on what they were.
Yeah, we got a query in actually from a listener, Brendan Griffin. He said he regularly follows the podcast and he wants to know how come there are 49 cases confirmed when on the day he wrote and 20 suspected cases. In the case of this one, it's the latest figures that you quoted there, it's 48 confirmed, I think, and 14 suspected. How are there suspected cases in ICU when the turnaround time for testing in hospital is quick? How are they all not confirmed, I suppose, is his question.
Well, if someone's critically ill and their life is in danger, they need to go to intensive care now. So you can't wait on the test result. So they'd have to be moved quickly and then they'll go down in the system as a suspected case, you know, pending the test result. It may be that all the symptoms are very indicative of COVID-19, but even the test result isn't totally clear that that's the cause. And this is a very tricky, very difficult virus, and there will be false negatives too. So these people, they're categorized in as much as the doctors believe with a high degree of certainty that they are likely to be COVID-19 cases. But the bottom line is, if you have to be in intensive care, you have to go there now.
The other numbers we've been looking at, Fergal, is the kind of the ages of people who've been affected and some of the underlying conditions. And you got some new information on that today. What did you learn?
Yes, we've got up-to-date figures in relation to deaths. And these figures are from the Health Protection Surveillance Centre. So we know that so far there have been 1,615 deaths related to COVID-19. Now we see that of those, 1,400 had an underlying clinical condition. Now, the data that's published, it's raw data. We don't see what those underlying conditions are. But if you think about what the at-risk conditions are, some of them must be things like heart disease, diabetes, obesity, lung conditions, compromised immune systems.
Yeah,
a whole range of conditions. So when you look at that over 86% of the confirmed or probable deaths from COVID-19 had an underlying illness. So, you know, it is a significant figure.
And ages, Fergal, what can we tell from that? Because we hadn't had very young children amongst the fatalities of it heretofore. What do the latest figures tell us? Has that changed at all?
No, the median age of deaths is 84 years of age. I mean, this is a virus that particularly targets older people, and particularly older people who with particular vulnerabilities in terms of their health status. They might have a number of medical conditions already. But the deaths that have been seen are in an age range of 17 years of age up to 105 years of age. And the case fatality rate, which is the proportion of deaths from the number of diagnosed cases, is 5.5%. We also see data from the number of people who have been admitted to intensive care units. So 395 people have been admitted to intensive care units overall to date. Most of those going into intensive care would actually be around the ages of, you know, 55 to 74. However, we do see that two patients aged between 5 years and 14 years were in intensive care, and five people aged between 15 and 24 years of age have been in intensive care. And there have been six patients aged 85 years or older who've gone into intensive care. Now, that number is low. Doctors would tell you that the reason the number is low is that for people in that age group, there would be a clinical decision taken as to whether there would be benefit or ability to cope with being in an intensive care unit environment and being under ventilation. So there would be clinical decision making, a very difficult clinical decision making there, you know, in consultation with families and doctors.
All right. Okay, thanks a million, Fergal.
Take care of yourself. Cheers.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that's all for this episode of Pandemic. We're back tomorrow with more. In the meantime, do get in contact with suggestions or questions by email to colm.omongain@rte.ie. That's colm.omongain@rte.ie. Or on Twitter @ColumOmongain. Do subscribe through your usual podcast platform to get this podcast regularly. Reviews are welcome. And of course, nice reviews even more welcome. So until tomorrow, take care. See you.